I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, I'm David Kern.
And I'm Heidi White.
And the absence of Tim that you hear there is because Tim is not here there.
He's still living.
Right.
Before any rumors
get started. He's on Earth. Right. He just, you know, couldn't be here today because he is traveling.
A productive adult human with a job. Yeah,
his job sent him out west, I think to Arizona. And so he could not be with us this week. We discussed trying to find a time to schedule it, but alas, couldn't make it work. So Heidi and I will carry on and do our part.
Hold down the fort, but that's like the opposite of the metaphor you used. So, or idiom you used.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't want to mix that up.
You wanted to stay and hold down the fort, and I was saying we're going to go somewhere.
Blaze some trails.
Exactly. Blaze some trails. So we don't have our chief scout. I don't know. We'll have to just... The point is, we're going to do this episode anyway. So so we're here to discuss the second portion of Ernest J. Gaines' book, A Gathering of Old Men. And that'll take us through roughly chapter... page 110. So... the last character who speaks that we're going to be with is Roof, Joseph Seabury, a.k.a. Roof. So page 110 in most editions. But it kind of takes us through most of the introduction of Mapes, the sheriff, and the sort of characters defending them and telling their stories, explaining their reasons for why they're doing what they're doing in a way that sort of only could work with Mapes, I think. So we talked last week about the idea of the points of view. That was kind of the main focus of our conversation last week. And we were talking about our enthusiasm for it. I think we both still like this book. I like this book still. You still like this book?
Oh, yeah. I think it's fantastic.
So has anything shifted for you in terms of clarifying things because of the point of view part? I don't want to let that thread go before we start talking about all kinds of other things. So we've been given a couple more points of view. Joe Dimes in particular comes at the beginning of this section. And, you know, this is a white man who kind of knows the sheriff and acts as kind of like this weird bridge between these characters. So for you, how did the new points of view impact your experience with this story?
Yeah, I think that with the section narrated by Lou Dimes, we get a lot more insight into... It's a white man talking about the inequalities in the culture. Although, I mean, not overtly, right? I mean, but that's kind of the gist of where he gets to. And it was really effective, I think, on the part of Ernest Gaines to put a lot of these thoughts into the mouth of a white man who would have the freedom in the culture to say this, right? And so it seemed like a technical move that really worked to me. Like, I'm so enthralled by the writing in this book. And that's usually you, David. Like, that's usually how you are. You're usually the one. I'm like all in the themes and blah, 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 the characters and the psychology. And you're the one who keeps kind of roping it back into, yeah, but what about the writing? And for me, I am enthralled for sure with the story. But I just keep noticing these like pro moves on the part of the author. He's a really masterful writer because with Lou Dimes' section, which is a bit longer than some of the sections that we had before.
Get two longish sections here.
Two long sections. And I thought it was such a pro move on Ernest Gaines' part to put a lot of these thoughts, because then we get a white man passing some judgment on these other white men that are coming and threatening. And of course, we believe the black narrators. Of course we do. But now we know that also another white man sees them as brutal and scary and to be feared. And then also Lou Dimes also gets the opportunity then to tell us about MAPES, right? From a perspective that... of a white man about a white man, which is a very different perspective than a black man towards a white man in this culture, which we're learning as we go. And so that is, I just thought that was really insightful on Ernest Gaines' part to put that in there and kind of invite us into seeing these characters from multiple points of view in the social status.
I like your point about how MAPES is introduced by Lou Dimes, because you got this, you got, we first meet him from the perspective of Lou, who is sympathetic to these characters, but not without his own sort of, I don't know, prejudices. I mean, like, he's, you know, he's not, it's not like he's this perfectly heroic character.
Right. Well, and he's protective of his fiance, he's protective of Candy, and so we get to see that in him too.
Right. And he kind of sees the situation for what it is, but then also as it's happening, his empathy for these guys does come out in a way that kind of like almost stands in for the reader, I think. But then we do get, as you said, him introducing MAPES, the sheriff. So we get one particular POV on the sheriff, but then we also do get the POV from one of the black men. And even from them, they have a sort of respect for MAPES. I mean, even if in times it's a little begrudging, at least within the situation, but it points out how MAPES liked Matthew and they hunted together, they fished together, they drank together in Matthew's house, right? So they view him as someone who's straddling the line between ally and enemy. He's like got this, you know, Lou says that line about how early on, like something like someone has to pay, right? The question of justice comes up. And MAPES has this weird role of having to, you know, I wonder if I can find it. Well, he says somebody had to pay for Bo's lying there. That's what he says on 63 at times. But MAPES has that, he has to play the sort of arbiter of justice, the one who has to determine whether justice can be met. But he also is friendly with these guys and he has a lot of respect for these guys. And he recognizes that in some ways they're very similar, even as there are these very significant differences in terms of the way the world and the world that they live in treats them and the freedoms they have and the respect that they get. But he's different than the guys that are off on the horizon that are the true enemy. So I like that one thing, the way he inserts these questions of justice while also giving us the sort of lay of the land as far as who's on whose side. Because you have this small army of these men who are standing their ground, so to speak, and are prepared to defend themselves and to stand up for themselves. And then offstage still, we have Fix, you know, Bo's family, these seemingly villainous characters who we've not even met yet, but even the sheriff and the deputy and the undertaker and all these people are afraid of them. And then in the middle of them, we have Lou, these two white men, Lou and MAPES and Candy. So two white men and a white woman who have a sense of the history of the place, like the true complexity of it and the injustices that have been met. And so they have a bit more of a nuanced or complex view of justice, even as MAPES has to like enforce justice, like try to make sure that justice happens. And he's like, his increasing confusion about what to do is really interesting in this part. I think it's one of the things that I like the best.
What do you make of him, David? Like, how's your, he's a very complex character. Mm-hmm. Maybe the most, him and Matthew, right? They're the most complex kind of, we don't know. I don't feel like the story tells us what to think about them the way it does about some of the other characters. And I'm okay with that the story tells us what to think about some of the characters, but I really like that Mapes is a bit ambiguous for sure, and maybe even ambivalent. Like, I don't know. What do you make of him? Like, what's motivating him in this section?
Hey, on this question, we haven't had any point of view from either of those, either Matthew or Mapes yet.
No.
I wonder if
Mapes.
I don't know. I wonder if we do at any point.
Because I didn't check.
Because
I haven't looked ahead at all.
The only thing, I haven't read ahead. I'm just wondering if, you know, that would be pretty telling, because it would associate the two very closely in terms of how we're supposed to think about the story. I see a bunch more Lou as I'm flipping ahead. I don't think I see any. I see some Snookum. I see Coot. So these are two pretty crucial characters that are not going to have, they're going to be revealed exclusively through other people. And their version of the story is not going to be there.
Exactly. And because we know, which I think is, I think that might be a really good move, because this is a memory novel, even though it doesn't feel like it. It feels like the very progressive, like everything's moving forward, but it is a novel about people looking back on an event. And so we know that every single narrator survives this confrontation. And so the silence of the people that we don't have narrating leaves that question mark in our minds, if we're the kinds of readers who look ahead, right? And look at, I wonder if Mapes has a section. I wonder if Matthew has a section.
Oh, yeah, that's a great point.
I wonder if Candy has a section, you know? Like, and as we look ahead and we see, no, these are mostly the periphery characters. I don't want to say minor characters because they're the ones speaking. But we have this tight group of inner characters that we don't ever, it seems, get to really hear from. And I find that kind of awesome, actually. That's a bold move on the part of Ernest Gaines to give us side characters or peripheral characters that are telling us about these main characters, and then we don't get to hear from them, which leaves the question,
really,
do they survive this confrontation? And also then we get to have our own judgments and posture towards them and our own perspective on them, and we don't get behind their eyes.
So on the one hand, we then get maybe marginalized is the wrong characters, but margin characters, right, being given their voice. But also heightens the drama, because every time we get a new chapter, we're not getting one of them. It raises the question more into our consciousness.
Right?
Yeah. Did they make it? Yeah. They're not being there. Their absence begins to become conspicuous. Now, you asked me about what I think of him.
Yeah.
And one of the things that makes him complex, I think, is what I said earlier, that we get him from different points of view. You know, we're being given an introduction to him from different points of view that come from different walks of life. So he commands the fact that he commands respect and even a degree of friendship, both among the black men and among at least Lou and Candy. That's telling. That he's able to sort of straddle that line is pretty telling, while also eating candy like a child. Like, that's those of us who like candy appreciate this, but I just, interesting that he draws so much attention to that. Cause like his contemplative state is to be eating lifesavers, you know, like the more he's thinking, the more he's eating, like that's a signal he's thinking. And I don't really know what to make of that. What did you think of that?
I mean, I couldn't help, of course, but think of David Kern, a resident snacker. And you're eating right now Doritos.
Well, so we've been, so
be aware.
little promo for Withy Windle podcast, because this is a podcast for kids book authors, right? And every episode we begin with a question that was asked by one of the kids, and it's the most important question we ask these authors. What do they like, or do they prefer Cheetos or Doritos? So the other day, Graham and I are interviewing Jonathan Oxier, who was a great middle grade novelist, and he's talking about how much he loves Doritos and how he's been like obsessing with them. So that kind of made me start to crave Doritos. So I was at the store running in to grab something quick to eat, and so I'm checking out. So naturally, I couldn't resist.
Of course,
right.
It's time to snack,
right?
Because you're thinking about something,
right? Exactly.
Got to ruminate with
exactly.
Right. Yep. So maybe that's what Mapes is doing. He does seem to eat to like calm himself down. And he's such a human character. Like he eats all the time and he's kind of fat, which is very different from David Kern. I'll say that right now.
I was chewing when you said that.
Yeah. Right. Indeed. Yes. Okay. So just as a side note, again, Jonathan Auxier, like I'm very intrigued by the fact that you said Doritos, right?
Cheetos. He said Doritos. Yeah.
Yeah. Because to me, like just his name and his books, I definitely picture him just like in a suit all the time and maybe snacking on like scones with clotted cream. Like he seems like a very
well. We didn't ask
classy,
him. Are you a scones?
Formal kind of. Yeah.
Do you prefer scones or cinnamon
Gardner,
rolls?
But yeah, right.
Night Gardener is a great Halloween book, by the way, for those of you that want to read books with your children.
Oh man, he is such a great. I can't wait to listen to that because I love him. His books are so good.
So where were we?
We were on Mapes and the snacking, and there's lots of little details like that in the book that are helpful place markers for me as we switch between points of view. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, so snacking is Mapes, right? Like this guy Matthew is tall. Like to have those kinds of details that help me keep the character straight. Although I do confess I had to go back and check several times this section, which is one of the risks of a POV changing kind of novel. It's hard for readers to keep track of who is who. Mm-hmm. But that's not a bad thing either, because it forces us as readers to pay attention and to keep flipping through. And that's not a bad thing. But I did this week have to go back and remind myself who is who a couple of times.
It was pretty,
but
you know, I mentioned my pet peeve of POV sounding exactly the same last week. Mm-hmm. And I did notice how Luz has a very unique way of speaking. Like each of these characters, with a little bit of study on them, you could create a profile, like a linguistic profile that differentiates each of them.
Smart. She's just a good writer. But Mapes, is he a villain? Is he bad? Is he like, what does he want? What's he motivated by in this scene? Or in this, I keep thinking of it as a scene, by the way. That was maybe a little bit of a Freudian slip. I didn't mean to say that, but it does feel like a scene.
Is he a villain? Well, I think the evidence of Gaines's skill here is that when he arrives, he's the enemy. You know, when the section begins, he's the enemy to the men on the porch, who we have now decided are our friends, right? And who we're behind. And as the section goes on and he hears the stories in that chapter that Roof tells, his stance seems to soften and his aggressiveness seems to chill out a little bit. Like, and he becomes, I think, increasingly less villainous and more. And villainous is a loose term here, obviously, because he's not like, I mean, he does at the beginning beat them, actually. So maybe it is the right word, because he does start out in this very combative way. And as it goes on, that seems to lessen. He seems to feel more complex about it. Although it does say at the beginning, he didn't want to be hitting them, but he didn't know what else to do.
Right.
So I think he's a very complex character. I think the real villains are off screen still, off stage.
Right.
What do you think?
Right. No, I had the same response. There's a couple things that surprised me in this section, one of which was Matthew, which I'm sure we'll come back to. When he started slapping them, I was surprised because I think I had expected from the way he had been talked about, maybe, I don't know if it was in my head or something from the text, I had expected him to have, I don't know, to be more just. Like, I was surprised and disgusted. Well, and of course it made me dislike him. But then later, I like what it seems like what he wants is what he truly wants really is justice, and he doesn't want them to be hurt. Like he doesn't want Fix to come, and he doesn't want a necktie party, as he called it. He doesn't want a lynching. Yeah. And it seems that and it's not just because he's trying to keep the peace. It seems like there's a genuine regard for some of these people that he's spent time with. But then there also just seems like he kind of just wants it to be easy and to be taken care of too. So I don't know that I think he's like a noble man, but I don't think he's a villain either. He seems kind of like an ordinary person who like usually does the right thing and is in over his head right now.
I like what you said about the justice question there, because part of the justice thing, like someone has to pay, is the line that Lou says, like someone has to pay for what happened, for Bo lying there in the grass. But there is also the concern that other people will die unjustly or get hurt unjustly. And that's like what he says to Matthew. Like, do you want these other people to get hurt? And he says, no, but they got to decide for themselves. And there's like, for Matthew and for all of these men, there's like a cause. There's something bigger than their own safety. And that's what it takes. That's what Mapes can't understand. And then as they begin to tell their stories, he begins to recognize why they would choose to do what they're doing. But he's not going to be able to convince, and you know, Matthew or any of them by saying, look, it's not, you could unjustly get hurt here. We know you didn't do it. And the interesting thing is the book seems to set us up to make him seem like a good police officer. Like he has a sort of, like he gets to the bottom of things. Like it doesn't take him long to go through the clues. Right.
He's smart.
Yeah.
Well, and then you also have Griffin, the deputy, who's obviously a sleaze. And so there's a good cop, bad cop kind of dichotomy set up at the beginning of the chapter.
Yeah, that's a good point. So what did you think of the chapter with all the narratives, the reasons that people are doing what they're doing?
Right. Roof's chapter, the long one.
Yeah.
I mean, it was heart-wrenching. Like these terrible things and these people who've, without a voice, who've been trained to bear that terrible suffering in silence across generations. Like it's just one story after the other. And I couldn't help but wonder how many of those stories had been drawn from real life somehow.
Yeah, Gaines have heard those somewhere.
Yeah. And so I thought it was very moving. And I mean, it definitely, I think if I were to have written that, it would be to raise awareness and to provide, is to give my readers insight into a true and a terrible history. And it did that. Like I definitely felt that, just like, oh my gosh, it almost to me bypasses the question of, should they be doing this? Like it almost, I thought for a while that maybe that was going to be the focus of the story, you know, kind of like when we read Peace Like a River. And one of the questions of the story was, should Davy have done this terrible thing? Was he justified in it? Right. And that carries through the whole story. You're constantly asking yourself that question while you're reading, and it influences how you think about this, the rest of the family on the run. And I don't really have that thread in the back of my, I almost like just accept it as a given that they're finally doing something. They're finally investing in the justice to themselves and their families. Like I'm not even asking myself the question, should they be there to protect Matthew? I am asking myself the question, should Matthew step forward and own it? But I'm not I completely understand and accept at face value the reason why there is this gathering of old men. And these stories have even added to that. I don't know. What about you?
Well, so what do you think of Matthew not coming? Basically saying, yeah, they do whatever they can decide. They can make the choices for themselves.
I don't know yet. Because I Matthew surprised me completely and utterly. I didn't expect him to be a man, like what Mapes said about how, or what Lou said about how Mapes respects Matthew. And and was the only man there that he did respect, made me see Matthew in a different light. I had been looking at him as like a weak man who lost his temper, and now everyone's stepping forward to protect him. But now this chapter has given me a different perspective on him. And since we have such limited vision of him, right? Like there's that, and that's got to be intentional on the part of our author, but he's always eclipsed by something, right? Like something's in between him and our view of him. And so I had made a judgment call that he was like a weak man who did this out of temper and rage. Mm. But now I'm thinking maybe there's a different perspective on him. Maybe he's very worthy of respect and worth protecting. There's got to be something about this man that's so compelling to the white sheriff and to everybody here and to Candy. But I don't know what it is yet.
Yeah, I mean, Candy's commitment to him, to them, is really interesting. And the fact that it hasn't been explained yet lends a bit of mystery as well. Like what is for her, is it a sort of grand, I don't mean that in a negative sense, but grand notion of justice. Like she sees the world in a more black and white way. This is wrong the way they're being treated. You know, does she owe something to somebody? You know, and in the sense that they did something for her and she feels like she wants to pay them back. You know, that we don't know that. We just know that she's this character who, like, does she actually like these people as men or does she like the cause, you know? And I don't think that's clear yet.
She does have a very deep attachment to Matthew, like an affection for him.
As there's that part at the end where she puts his hand on him and,
like a flower. Mm-hmm. That was such a beautiful, and in a book that isn't very gentle, that gentle touch was like very moving to me.
I'm wondering if based on the way you were talking about this longer chapter with their stories, it seemed like you were saying it's good, but so maybe I'm wrong in inferring that. Are you worried that perhaps it's like too, speechified,
right,
or something? Like it's a little
it did feel like a series of speeches,
which I guess it was,
right?
Does it lack subtlety?
Maybe it felt a bit on the nose to read, like, and I would have loved to have heard those. It seems like he could have maybe woven them into the character's first person points of view, because there are so many characters. And to be honest, I'm still not sure which story goes to which character because there are so
like,
many.
They could have told their own story in the narrative instead of hearing it through another person.
And I think that's a tough call as a writer in the craft sense, because if you get it woven through with each character, then you kind of miss this idea of Mapes hearing multiple stories and becoming overwhelmed by them, right? Finally hearing the truth for the first time. And so that barrage of stories kind of makes sense for the emotional power of that. But I think in reading it, to your point, I kind of stopped keeping track after a little while and just kind of heard disembodied sad stories.
I wonder if that's part of the point though, like
maybe so.
These are human beings to whom these things are happened to, who have been sort of disembodied. They haven't been treated as
humans. Dehumanized.
They've been dehumanized, right. Yeah. Were there any passages that particularly stood out to you in this chapter? This section?
I think I'd have to say no on that, because so much was on dialogue. I really just that little image, like I said, of Candy putting her hand on his shoulder.
Yeah, what is that? 110.
Where is that?
I think it was the last bit of the.
Yeah. I think that for me in the writing, I was moved by these little little moments, like the hand on the shoulder, when Yank was giving his name and he wanted his full name to be known and not just his nickname to be known, like little things like that, that just were, that I just thought were really powerful details that spoke to the underlying psychological and societal forces that are going on in this section. And then I also was very moved, and I'm not, this isn't a passage, but it hit me how much of the grief of the old men is about, it's certainly about issues of race and inequality and oppression, and also about memory and family and being old, right? Like seeing an old way of life disappearing mm-hmm. and being forgotten mm-hmm. under the pressure of oppression and under that oppressive system. But that kind of contemplation of memory and change and the force of change in a culture was compelling to me, but it didn't seem preachy, like this is just like big bad racism. It felt very human, like there's these men grieving the loss of their culture, the loss of the graves of their family and their stories, their own stories yeah. being forgotten. All of that under the pressure of an oppressive system. Like there's so many things that are pushing on these old men mm-hmm. and why that they're choosing this moment to say, to have a voice.
And one of the things that stands out in those stories is that they're finally getting to tell, like on the one hand, they are right. trying to give voice to people that were forgotten. And on the other hand, it's very confessional. Like you've got the one who's like, I didn't stand up for my brother. Mm-hmm. And now I'm basically, he's saying, and now I'm finally going to. I didn't, you know. But then each of those stories has somebody who had been forgotten. The boy who gets the chair, who had been, you know, maybe or maybe not falsely accused. But either way was all screwed up. The soldier who came back from the war mm-hmm. and was treated poorly. The man whose brother got beaten and he didn't do anything. For every one of them who tells the story, there's also the forgotten person that the story's about, those are the people that they're doing this for. It's for themselves, certainly, and for the future. And it's also for the people that they were not able to stand up for earlier, either because of the inequality of the justice system, the inherent racism of the local community, their own lack of courage in the moment, you know, whatever it is, they all can kind of seem to be giving a different reason. But those people are the reason that they're on the porch as much as themselves. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, it's so much less abstract when there's a person, when there's a 16-year-old kid right. who, you know, the story about how he thinks he's in heaven and getting electrocuted wasn't so bad. Those are, those are stories of people. And again, it feels like they can't have, they must have been things that Gaines had heard, you know, they feel so particular.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Well, I didn't hear from you about Matthew. What is your impression? As I find him very compelling now, in a way that I didn't before reading this section.
I'm pulling up this is the conversation between Mapes and Matthews, 84, 85, 86. One of the things I like about Matthew is how there's a sort of steadiness to him. He's not, there's a calmness to him. Candy tries to say, you don't have to talk. And he's like, I don't mind talking. And then Mapes says, tell them to tell me who did it. And it says that he looked at Matthew, never at Candy. He was still being respectful toward Matthew. And the fact, like that bit of characterization there that we learn about Matthew through the way other people treat him, that like mm-hmm. that secondary characterization is really well done, because he could say Matthew was the kind of character, the kind of man, who, because of his personality right. and his persona and the way he carried himself was given lots of respect, right? The people in the town respected him. Or we can say that the sheriff who is there investigating whether he killed someone is looking at Matthew, not at the woman who keeps trying to speak for him. And like, we learn everything we need to know about Matthew because of that in that moment. And then Matthew says, no, you know, I did it. And then Mape says, I know you did. You're the only one around here man enough. And so like, in a sense, what we have been given is all these stories, or what we're about to get is all these stories of people who look back at themselves and wish they'd been man enough to do something. But we're told here by the sheriff, you are man enough to do it. And Mapes, despite his commitment to making sure justice is met, seems to actually respect that about Matthew. And all the other characters wish they had been man enough to do something like that. And so the book seems to be saying that the fact that Mapes, Matthew, was man enough to, as Mapes is to use his phrasing, was man enough to do it, is something that we are supposed to admire, if not be comfortable with, right? Like, the book is saying that this isn't, this is, it's, you can both be like admirable and not admirable, like you can still wonder about it, but admire that he would be man enough to do something like that. The, in the framework of this book, that seems to be an admirable thing so far. We can talk about, you know, we can debate the real world philosophies and theologies behind that, but it, within the context of this book, we're supposed to respect that about him,
right?
And he says, you know, he also recognizes though that all these other men are not just standing up for him, that they're standing up for the community, they're standing up for the people before them, for their children, for the men from the First World War, the Second World War, the Korean War, and Vietnam, who all got treated like you know what when they came back. And so Matthew recognizes that, and that's why he's not willing to say, you know what, take me away, I did it. They're, you know, he lets them have, like, he lets them have the autonomy to decide whether or not to stand with them, which is what Jameson is not willing to do. Jameson doesn't recognize, he is not willing to give them, he doesn't respect their grieving enough to let them do what they think is right. Mm-hmm. And there's like a cowardice in that. And that's why Jameson comes across as little and Matthew comes across as big, even as they're actually big and small. But they, you can say they're big and small, but they don't, that doesn't mean they feel big and small. And sometimes an author will right. make a character tell us that a character is small, but he will feel big. And sometimes we'll be told that a character is tall, but he'll feel little. Here, Matthew feels big because he has a bigger view of the world. And he recognizes what's going on in the hearts of everyone around him. So I think he's a pretty compelling character.
He's so compelling. And it was until this section, and maybe what you're describing, everything you just said, I agree with and think is true, but I didn't know it or sense it or feel it until this section, really until that conversation that you just referred to, before he was this silent man squatting with a gun in his hand, having just killed a white man while everybody else is taking the blame. And so I put on that a wrong judgment that is corrected by this section. And I don't know if that's intentional on the part of our author, or whether that was just my own interpretation. Did you have the same experience, or did you always kind of find him to be more heroic or compelling? Well,
I think we don't know. You know, it's interesting because right before the section, Roof says, he's describing Mapes, and he says Mapes was a lot of things. He was big, mean, brutal. But Mapes respected a man. Matthew was a man. And Mapes respected Matthew, but he didn't think much of the rest of us, and he didn't respect us. And, you know, that seems to be inconsistent with, or consistent with sort of how they feel about themselves at times.
Right.
And that's coming across as they narrate their own stories. And so the fact that this big, mean, brutal man respects Matthew should, on the one hand, cause us to also respect Matthew because this authority figure does, but then also, in a way, it kind of should give us pause because this big, mean, brutal man has a sort of kinship with Matthew. And so it should make us wonder, right. Well, is Matthew also big, mean, and brutal? And if so, what do they each stand for within this book and the community, and like it just raises all these questions about what justice is, because
right,
is he big, mean, and brutal in terms of pursuing what he believes justice to be, his, you know, his job, but he respects a man, and so the way he goes about that, it, you know, he tries to go about that brutality, you know, it's complicated,
right? It is complicated,
and thus, well, their relationship is complicated. Sorry.
Right. No, that, sorry, you weren't done talking. Yeah, I'm also, we don't know anything about what happened between Matthew and Bo and why Bo
right.
was shot. Yeah, but it almost I think that's smart. But again,
neither do the other men.
This is what I'm saying. Like, this speaks to the craft of the novel. Like, this, it's so smart to not tell us, because then instead of Beau's death being about an incident that happened between him and Matthew, now it's not about that. It becomes then about this man's brother who came back from war, and this poor woman who was mistreated by men of both races and ended up dead, right? And like all of these terrible things that happened because of the oppression that's being explored in this novel, because of racism, because of all of these terrible things. That's what this man's death is about to the gathering of old men, right? And I think the absence of that bit of knowledge allows us as the reader, as you said, to become kind of the vessel of that, right? We're not just looking at what happened between Matthew and Bo and deciding whether or not Matthew made a good decision to shoot him. We're looking at this gathering of old men that are there finally taking a stand. And I assumed that Matthew was allowing them to do it because he was cowardly. Because I can't imagine doing something and letting people take the blame for it. Like, I just can't, like, I'm like, why would someone do that?
Yeah.
But to your point, and I couldn't come up with a noble reason for that. So then I passed judgment on him. But in this section, Yes. And then in this section, then we have this different vision of him as a man of great strength and that other people respect. And it is worth dying for, right? Worth fighting for. And their respect for him, like they look up to him for defending himself with whatever happened. And so then they want to kind of do something heroic like he did. They're imitating him. So I'm just seeing him in a new light in this section, but I still wonder.
So what do you think the book is going to do next?
I don't know.
Like what?
I'm surprised. I've been surprised so many times in reading it.
Well, what are you going to be looking for in terms of how these two characters, like what are the questions you have that you want to see answered?
I want to see a little more insight between on Matthew. I want to see, I'm hoping to learn more about his relationship with Candy. Kind of at this point, this feels to me like the heart of the novel. This section we just read, particularly the stories that were told, and like Mape's eyes being opened in a new way to these people as humans. What he does with that, I don't know, but at least he's being forced to see. And he said the words "I see" like six times in those couple of pages. But I am looking for more on Matthew. And of course, I'm looking for when is our villain going to show up and what's he going to do? I don't know. What about you? What are you looking for?
Yeah, I mean, we don't know why any of this, like what actually happened.
Right. I wonder if we will.
Yeah, exactly. What's Candy's actual role in this whole thing? There's a lot of ways that he could surprise us. Like Mapes, I mean, Matthew could have had nothing to do with it actually, you know, I don't think he's, if I wanted to pull a Tim and do a prediction, I would say, I doubt that's what he's doing because of a lot of the themes that he's introduced. Like, it doesn't seem like the kind of book where he's just going to be like, actually Candy did do it. And then Matthew convinced her to put this hash, this plot, you know, I'd be surprised.
I would be disappointed.
Yeah.
But it
yeah.
would be a twist.
And are we going to come to like, are the, is the way that these men get to stand up for the people that they didn't get to stand up for through, is it going to necessitate violence? Like, is that necessarily a violent standing up, or is that not going to be what is forced upon them in order to stand up for themselves? Right. Hey, one last question. You know that bit where they're talking about negation? Do you remember that?
Remind me.
So Johnny Paul, 88, he wasn't looking at Mapes. He was looking toward the tractor and the trailers out of Kane out there in the road. But I could tell he wasn't seeing any of that. I couldn't tell what he was thinking until I saw his eyes shifting up the quarters where his mama and papa used to stay. But the old house wasn't there now. It had gone like all the others had gone. Now weeds covered the place where the house used to be. "Y'all look," he said. "Look now. Y'all see anything? What y'all see?" "I see nothing but weeds, Johnny Paul," Mapes said, "if that's what you're trying to say." "Yes, sir," Johnny Paul said. He didn't look at Mapes. He was still looking up at the quarters. "Yes, sir, I figured that's all you would see. But what are the rest? But what do the rest don't see?" Like that, such the way this is all phrased. "What y'all don't see, Roof?" he asked me. He didn't look at me, still looking up the quarters. "What y'all don't see, Claytoo? What y'all don't see, Glow? What y'all don't see, Kareem, Rooster, Beulah? What y'all don't see, all the rest of y'all?" "I don't have time for people telling me what they can't or don't see, Johnny Paul. I want..." Johnny Paul turned on him. He was tall as Mapes, but thin, thin. He was the color of brown mule chewing tobacco. His eyes gray like Mapes' eyes, but not hard like Mapes' eyes. He looked dead at Mapes. "You ain't got nothing but time, Sheriff." "What?" Mapes said. "I did it," Johnny Paul said. "I see. Either I stand here and let you talk about things you don't see and things the others don't see, or I take you in. I see." "Yes, sir," Johnny Paul said. "But you still don't see." "Yes, sir, what you see is the weeds, but you don't see what we don't see." "Do you see it, Johnny Paul?" Mapes asked him. "No, I don't see it," Johnny Paul said. "That's why I killed him." "I see," Mapes said. "No, you don't," Johnny Paul said. "No, you don't. You had to be there to don't see it now. You just can't come down here every now and then. You had to live here 75 years to don't see it now. No, Sheriff, you don't see. You don't even know what I don't see." "Do you know what you don't see?" Mapes asked. Ask Matthew," Johnny Paul said. "No, I'm asking you," Mapes said. "I'll get back to Matthew later. Ask Glow, ask Tucker, Gable, Claytoo, ask Yang, Jameson there. Ask any of them, all of them, what they don't see no more." "All right," Mapes said. "Tell me, but make it quick. I gotta get in some fishing." "You still don't see. You still don't see." "I don't have to make quick nothing. I can take all the time in the world I want, and it ain't nothing you can do but take me to jail. You can't slap me hard enough to hurt me no more, Sheriff." "I see," Mapes said. I thought that conversation was really interesting. It's a little bit on the nose, but also it's really well done, because at first it's like you kind of messes with your brain a little bit, but then when he gets to that last line and Mapes says, "I see," it's as if he does see finally. Like when he says, you can't slap me hard enough to hurt me no more, Sheriff, Mapes is finally realizing that's why they kept getting up. That's why they fell in line to get slapped. That's why they're not giving each other up, because getting thrown in prison or whatever, that's not, it doesn't mean anything to them anymore. So what did you make of this conversation? Do you think it's too on the nose? That was kind of my question.
No, I don't. I think it works. And honestly, I think it works because Johnny Paul's repeating himself like people do when they have a really important point to make, right? And they can't get it across. And so you just like say it louder and more
like people on the
podcast,
like us on the podcast. Yes,
exactly. And so I think it almost works because of its repetition and vehemence, because that feels like a real conversation. And it doesn't feel to me it doesn't feel forced. And I think that question of negation of what it is that Mapes as the representative of the, what adjectives am I going to choose here? We'll see what comes out of my mouth in a second. the ordinary, but fairly like weak-minded, not like a man who is not bad or wicked, but is whose strength and sense of nobility and justice is insufficient to the to what he's asked to do, his vocation, right? Mm-hmm. He's the sheriff. He should be seeking for justice. And instead he's like, let me just try to get this thing like figured out without doing too much harm. Mm-hmm. So I can get back to fishing, you know? So he's not a bad guy, but he's not quite good enough, morally good enough, you know, to the situation at hand.
But when it's over, do you agree with me? Do you think he finally does see?
I do. What, and seeing is, again, it's good, but seeing isn't good enough. In a situation like this, he's going to have to take action in order to do any good here. And he's going to have to take a very countercultural action on behalf of these Black men. And how that looks and how it even ought to look, I think, is unclear. Mm. Like, you know, if you were to sit down, one thing we haven't even talked about is like, what should he do here?
Mapes.
What choice does he have? What ought he to do? Because he's not confronted. And in his mind, it's an incident, right? But he gets here and he finds out this is more than an incident. This is a stand that these men are taking on behalf of their own history. And what we have Johnny Paul here saying is like, you don't see us. You don't see our history. Mm-hmm. You don't know.
You don't see what we've lost.
This isn't about Matthew and Bo.
Yeah.
This is about all the things you don't see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And have refused to see. Mm-hmm. And so Mapes is in a situation that I frankly wouldn't know what to do in. I think he hasn't showed himself to be a noble or good enough man to be sufficient to it or wise enough for it. He's just going to have to be.
That'll be interesting to see what happens. Like, how does he reveal himself? Like, what does he reveal about himself through the rest of this book, and what impact does his choices make on the gathering?
Right.
It's interesting that it's called The Gathering, because it's not the fallout of The Gathering, and the whole book is called The Gathering. So
it's The Gathering, yeah. Right? Yeah.
Well, speaking of gathering, you need to get on an airplane so that we can gather here in Concord, North Carolina, to do some planning for Close Reads for 2022.
That's right.
So this weekend, Tim and Heidi are going to be here, and we're going to be discussing plotting some things for next year. Yeah, what she said. Do you want to have any other final thoughts?
No. I'm just really eager to find out what happens next. It's been a while since I've been kind of on tenterhooks in a book. Like, what will happen?
You should read the new John Le Carré book.
I will. I absolutely am going to do that.
It's not very long. So, you know,
which
how
is
I
surprise.
Feel about that.
Yep. I know.
So that's probably should be a bingo card for the Close Reads bingo thing. okay. So we've got, don't forget to check out the Place the Thing, Tim and Matt and, oh shoot. Who else is on?
Nora.
That's right. So save me. They're doing the Taming of the Shrew right now. Three acts are up. I believe the fourth one goes up. It might be up by the time this episode goes live. This Close Reads episode goes live. If you have kids or you just like kids' books, be sure to tune into Willy Wendell. Graham and I are having a great time with that. We have two episodes of season two up, and the third one goes up today, the day this Close Reads episode drops. We also just launched a new podcast called Bibliography. On that show, I'm chatting with interesting people about the books they love. So the first episode is with Ron Rash. That is now available. You can subscribe to that wherever you get podcasts. If you had already subscribed to our old Libromania feed, you already have access to that. But episode one is with Ron Rash, who is a great North Carolina writer. And I wanted to make sure that he was our first episode. I've got about 8, 9, 10 episodes, something like that, in the can. So, you know, be ready to check that out. We'd love for you to listen. So I guess that about covers all the business. Anything else from you, Heidi?
No.
Mm-mm. All right. Well, then for Heidi White, for Tim McIntosh, Tim in absentia McIntosh, I'm David Kern. Till next time, happy reading.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.